Well, hello everybody. I'm Brian Jacobs, and welcome to this edition of the ASI Cast. And I'm delighted to say that today we're joined by Karen Nelson Field, author, I think I should probably say, author of several books. The latest one of which is the one we're going to talk about, The Attention Economy: A Category Blueprint. So, hi, Karen.
Hello again. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. You too. Well, I mean, I've been through the book, and I really like it. I think it's very different from most business books that you come to read. Apart from anything else, I mean, it's a sort of great mixture of theory and science, but also pragmatic advice. I think the bit you've got these bits about, meanwhile back in the real world sort of sections, which I think are a brilliant idea, and that you actually take what you've learned and apply it. I do. I think it's great. I think it's really good. I think anyway, any book that starts off with a quote on page one, chapter one, line one, from Moira from Schitt's Creek has got to be a winner in my book anyway. So, congratulations. I think it's great. It's
Oh, thank you.
a really good
That's
book.
was a great show, so you
Yeah,
got to start.
it's a great show,
That
exactly.
is actually the precursor to, I try and introduce a whole lot of funnies along the way because I
Yeah.
think, you know what? We're not curing cancer here. Let's just, have some fun with it all and try and keep it light.
Yeah, I think that's a great piece of advice for anybody writing a business book of any sort, actually, because they can get terribly heavy, and they can get really a bit up themselves as well. And I think the fact that this one has got jokes in it, and it's got contributions from all sorts of people, of course, outside of not just you, and I think that breaks it up as well. And I think it's really good, really, really good. So let's get into some of the issues that you raise in the book, which I think I'm sure people in this audience would love to hear about. Maybe we can kind of start by saying, at the beginning, you make the point, you do a lot of stuff on the history of attention studies, for want of a better expression, studies into this kind of work. And I think you take it back to about the 1960s, I think is as far back as you go, first study that you could find, or first piece of work that you can find. So this stuff has been around for a long time. I mean, it's been around for a long time. We've been talking about this for ages. I mean, I remember, I was planning, this was a big issue. Maybe we didn't have the data or the knowledge or the science behind it, but we were very well aware that obviously people pay more attention to certain things than other things, and there's a need to understand what those things are and try and somehow or other categorize them. So why do you think it is that here we all are, whatever it is, 60 odd years later, and it's now getting, if you'll excuse the pun, the attention that it deserves, this whole topic. Why now, do you think?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think I call that the boring chapter just to let everyone know that, it's a precursor to the rest of the book. But I've had lots of people say actually it wasn't boring, which sounds to me like you didn't find it boring either.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to understand the history because I get kind of tired of, not tired, I guess I get sort of a little bit tired of people kind of talking about what is the value of attention, right? And so I kind of wanted to include the history because I, to your point, this is not new news that attention is an important, I guess, part of the advertising sort of flow. And it goes way, way back before that. I mean, you've probably heard me talk about the fact that attention economics is not actually a marketing thing. There's a lot of other ecosystems that use attention economics to improve, road safety and education and, all that sort of thing. So I think the importance of that is for people to really understand that because there was a whole era of, in the last, settled down now, particularly with IB, the MRC, SIM, ARF kind of jumping on, but there was this whole era of people saying, well, what is the definition of it? And I use that chapter kind of to show that we didn't need to reinvent the wheel and there was so much work done on it. But I also used it to show all of the amazing studies that have gone through the history of time that have looked at attention and outcomes, that have looked at attention and memory, that have looked at attention and, impact of other ways, just so people get a bit of a refresher that this is not new news. And, because, obviously people realize I'm a researcher, so I wanted to include everyone else's history around, the value of attention, so that it didn't seem so, bias around my stuff. But you also said, why is it getting the attention now? And I think, it is a credit to the industry. There's a few of us that have been pounding the pavement for a while. Obviously, I think Mike Follett's work is really valuable, and there's a few others that do sort of good work that is quite credible and validated. And I think that finally the industry has listened. And I think today's issue is more of a systemic one through the media planning and through the media ecosystem than it ever was. So I think, the industry has listened. As you would know, the MRC are working through standards at the moment. And obviously, the last time this happened, viewability became a thing. So I think it's now, its time is now.
Yeah, it's
And
interesting.
that's
I mean, you talk about the sort of the history of this, and I was around for this some of this, and one of the things I remember back in my days at Leo Burnett, I used to work very closely with Simon Broadbent,
Oh, yeah.
my sort of mentor, I suppose, at Burnett.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Simon did, and I remember this really clearly. I remember it made a great impression on me. He said one day, he said something about, I just don't think we pay anything like enough attention, as it were, to how people actually use different channels and what they actually do with the different channels. And Simon took himself off for a few days, and he went and sat in the homes of people and watched people watching television, right? So this is obviously, this is a bit like kind of, T vision for the old days, as it were. So Simon went and he just sat in the corner. I mean, what on earth these people thought of having some sort of weird bloke sitting in the corner watching them, I don't know. But he did it, and he came back and he wrote quite a lengthy piece about this, and he spoke to clients about it a lot. And it made all the sense in the world to sort of say, well, actually, here's what people actually do when they're watching television.
So it's funny you say that, Brian, because that's what inspired me to build the methodology that I did. Not his work, but a whole lot of work that I was exposed to when I was still an academic, and they were called the Ball State University studies, and they did the same thing. So I think it was a week they did that. They followed
Yeah.
what 4 or 5 days, I can't remember exactly, but they were really seminal at its time because they watched people watching or interacting with media. And what was striking was that how people interacted with media was very vastly different to what most people thought. And but the passive nature of the methodology, albeit there was a creepy person in the room, is ethnographics, right? So that literally inspired me to think about a way to build our ethnographic collection processes at scale. Then I was introduced to computer vision. Then I was, off on a path. Well, this is the way that we can do Ball State University studies, but at scale, in a similar way, without having a creepy person in the room.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just coming much, much more up to date, so just a mere 20 odd years ago, I remember the work that Robert Heath did. I know you quote Robert Heath in the book, and I remember watching him present and listening to some of his studies being explained and reading something about what he did. Now, he it seemed to me, was sort of, I wouldn't go so far as to say he was anti-attention, but his whole point was about low involvement processing, wasn't it? That people actually remember stuff even though they haven't apparently seen it. I don't
And
think
we
they
say that all the time. We say that all the time. So the way, firstly, the methodologies are very different. And he was also looking at emotive ads in most cases, whereas we're kind of not. We look at non-emotive and emotive. But the interesting thing about his work is he describes passive attention beautifully. So I've been on this bandwagon, as you know me for a long time now, for 8 years in this business. And there is a distinct difference between the value of active and passive attention, but they're both important for different reasons. So, to your point, he is correct. Passive attention works just differently than if you're looking straight at something to with intention to learn.
So he's not wrong. It's just that this
He's
is a
not
different,
wrong.
yeah. It's a
No.
different form of attention, I think. Yeah.
It's a type of attention. Correct. It's a
It's a
type of
type of
attention.
attention. Yeah. I mean, along a similar, I mean, you mentioned earlier about how attention studies per se are obviously not a marketing, are not limited to a marketing thing, as it were. They're obviously, how people pay attention to things is obviously a very rich seam, as it were, to explore. Along a sort of similar path, that got me thinking about the way in which people, let's say, in our world, the people way in which people watch TV shows. So let's just take this, cut this right back to the bone, as it were, and talk about something which I appreciate is not what happens nowadays, but, and obviously it's, I'm going to oversimplify, but let's say someone's watching a TV show that is really involving, really engaging, and they're really up for it, really paying full attention to it. And then a commercial break comes along, okay? Is that, I mean, the debate we always used to have was, is that necessarily a good thing to be in that commercial break? In other words, does people's attention carry over into the commercial break, or is it more a kind of, oh God, phew, you know, trust, a break from all that emotion, as it
No.
were?
So the more, so obviously we collect TV too, a bit like TV vision. So what we see is that the more engaged they are in the program, it does actually move across to the ad breaks as well. And what we can see, particularly in really good, so you think about all the amazing stuff you watch on Netflix or catch up TV, and you don't want to miss, you know, you want to be back for it, or if you've not got the ad supported, whichever one you have. But you know, it's we see that the higher the engagement in the programming, the higher the attention during the ad break. And that's largely because people are kind of coming straight back in to kind of make sure that they don't miss the, depending on the ad format itself, but they don't miss the start of the next bit. And the beautiful thing about the streaming services like that is that in regular television, you know, there's five ads, you can almost count all 5 minutes. You know, in different countries, they're really prescriptive around the ad breaks and how long they are and how much time they have and, you know, how they're ended, you know, double ended with, you know, kind of promotion at one end of and the other with the same network. So you kind of know the format, whereas with these, they don't so much. So yeah, it's truth.
It does carry across.
It
What
does
about,
carry
I mean,
across.
do people get irritated by it? I mean, do you measure irritation in any way or
We
not?
don't. I mean, we, you know, the way that we collect data is we are using the facial detection for understanding the trajectory of the view. We have, as you probably have heard, just overlaid emotions AI onto our stack, so we can actually recalibrate for emotions, but it, to be honest, it doesn't pick up something around irritation in that way.
You're quite you had a very, there's a fascinating piece in the book, or series of pieces I should say, in the book, about the sort of overall state of the world, as it were, and the state of the industry. And it strikes me that there used to be a comparatively small gap between what we measured in terms of how people viewed or used media channels and the result. In other words, the result, the business result. I mean, so in other words, you know, you buy more GRPs on TV back in the simplistic days, and you sell more beans. And the more GRPs you buy, the more beans you sell, as it were. And back then, we knew pretty well what a GRP was. We knew pretty well how many beans we were talking about. And so, you know, that was a reasonably straightforward kind of comparison. And now it seems to me that there's a really enormous gap. First of all, we can't agree what it is we're buying. And we can't even agree how to define what it is that we're buying. And we've certainly got no clue anymore whether or not whatever it is we're buying shifts more beans or not. So we seem to have got from a point of being a pretty straightforward relationship between the stuff you're buying and then what happens to the business. And today, when we can't decide what it is we're buying, and we don't know if it's shifting the business anyway. So we seem to have moved a long way.
There's
And
more to that.
yeah,
There's, sorry.
I just wondered your thoughts on that. I mean, we've got to this point. I mean, how do we get out of this? I mean, we seem to
Well,
have.
it's you probably saw or read that I talk about cost per minute 1,000, and in the same way, basically, it's even more multidimensional than that. So you talked about, you know, beans. We don't know what the perceived. We can't relate what we're buying or what we're measuring to the beans. So you've got two issues there. The measurement's wrong and the beans don't mean what they meant anymore, if that sort of makes sense, keeping on the theme. But then on top of that relationship between, you know, measurement and the beans varies across 20,000 different formats, right? So if the relationship or the error was standard across what you're measuring in your beans, then we could almost deal with that, but it's not. So there's this extra sort of third dimensional layer which is where I came back with, obviously, so many years ago now, the concept of not all reach is equal. But people, it's a multidimensional issue. So the perceived value of impressions is not the same on every platform. And how we measure it, if we use, you know, the platform's measurement of their own, is very different to other people. So there's no standardization around that, except for viewability, but there's a gap with that anyway. But then on top of that, to my point, is that that relationship between what they're measuring and then how that relates to outcomes, or and how many impressions you need for that those outcomes, is so different by platform and format. So it's this dog's breakfast, quite frankly.
I mean, but you said, I mean, you just said just then that not all reach is equal is a phrase you've been bandying around for some time. Are people hearing this though? I mean, do they, are they taking
they
it
do.
On board?
It's an interesting one, because if I'm really honest, I, you know, the first book was 5 years ago, and I knew there was something in Not a Reach is Equal, but I probably couldn't explain it as deeply as I can now. Now I understand exactly the nuances that sit behind the media trading ecosystem that is why this is happening. And I've said in the book, in chapter two, that it's largely to do with what I call the Achilles heel of our industry, which is time and view. So time and view, when we switched, I mean, I'm older, I went through the transition from, you know, traditional media to digital. And the choice to use time and view as the default scene measure was the point in time when our industry broke and was never going to survive into another generation, because time and view counter means nothing to whether an ad is seen or not. It just means if it's on the screen. And that is the core Achilles heel of why not all reach is equal, because that relationship between time and view and attention varies significantly across all platforms and formats.
And who are the promoters of time and view? One asks oneself.
Yeah, you can answer that one on stage.
Exactly. I mean, that's...
look, you know, I think it wasn't a silly. I think the lack of, I guess, research into its stability was a critical error. But to your point, there were, you know, it was exploding. There were, you know, CEOs of big publishers that, you know, just wanted something like that because it was easy and quick, and there we are.
Yeah, and it's the same. I mean, you know, you can take it onto other measures, other metrics like clicks. You know, for example, I mean, one, you know, certainly in the newspaper. I know you used to work in the newspaper business years back, but
I
in
did.
the newspaper business today, certainly over in this country, we've got CEOs of publishing of big newspaper publishers saying, "What counts is the number of clicks or the amount of time that is spent with an article," and you sort of think, well, no, it isn't. It just isn't. I mean, it just isn't. And but that's how journalists are being judged. You know, that's how, you know, whether or not you keep your job depends on whether or not you hit those key metrics. And the key metrics,
and, you
it
know,
seems to
the
be the law.
clickbait journalism is another whole ethical conversation unto itself. You know, it's this. So if you think about what you just said, you just described, so between time and view and clicks, it's really in, I guess it's really changed our entire human ecosystem, really, in terms of, you know, how we think and what we read and et cetera.
Well, I think that's a whole other subject, isn't it? Another
yes.
book. Another book.
No, I'm good.
You're good with books. What about, I mean, you say somewhere, you say in the book somewhere that a very interesting phrase, I thought, you said people watch ads the way the platforms train them to. And you talk about fast decay rates and slow decay rates. Could you explain a bit more about that and what you meant by that?
Yeah. So what's interesting, when you have 38 billion, and we've got more now, but we call it at 38 billion human data points. So this has nothing to do with the data, the device, or the data that sits behind the view, you know, the metadata. This is literally biometrics. When you've got that much data, you start to see bigger patterns, and you start to be able to use really amazing computational methods to kind of understand the why. And one of the interesting things that we started to see was that there were systematic patterns between platform, format, ad length, etc. And what we kind of worked out was actually what drives the opportunity for attention is the way that Facebook Reels or Facebook Watch is built. It's got nothing to do with amazing ads, to be honest. A little to do with amazing ads, but not as much as you think. So when I talk about that, it's basically if you think about how you're trained to use Facebook or how you're trained to watch Snapchat or how you're trained to watch, TikTok or whatever it is, so is the other trillion people in the world doing it in the same way. So while creative can, slightly amplify the norm, you are bounded, your creative is bounded by that user experience. So if you think about that, that's great for an industry that wants to measure something because it's not random. That's really good news because most people think that the way they pay attention and that as a human being you're unique, but it's not. So there are systematic ways, regardless of your age group, that largely we all watch the same way. So that really has a huge flow-on effect to creative cut through, and it also has a huge flow-on effect to ad length. And to your point, it's how the reason why we know that is because of the way that the viewing distributions happen behind the experience. So we can predict, your attention based on what we know about distributions that we've seen before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean this should really be a very useful steer for anybody creating, shouldn't it? I mean, if you
I
understand how
agree.
people are using a channel, then obviously by definition you create for the channel, by
I
definition,
think
you
I
know, so.
might even say in the book that these two little things. So it's how many people for how long. So the shape of how you view, so the distribution of how you view and how many people are literally the prediction, that they're the keys to prediction.
Yeah.
And when you know them, you know exactly how to restore reach, how to restore cost per meaningless thousand back to CPM, how to optimize in flight, how to and what, all sorts of things, what creative you can use, what ad length, what, what it's they are literally the two little things that sit at the absolute heart of every product that we put out because they tell us what to expect.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could end by asking you two sort of last questions. I mean, what if I could ask you sort of what surprised you the most when you were doing all this? I mean, you obviously, you spent a long time writing this book clearly, and you've taken evidence, as it were, or got contributions from all over the place, like I said. What kind of surprised you when you were going through it and writing it?
So nothing surprising when I was personally writing my side of it because we'd been. So my favorite chapter is chapter two, which is Big Little Learnings, and then my next favorite one after that is Attention Science as a Science because we've known for a long time because we don't ever just do one study and launch it publicly and go, yay, we found something. We might repeat it 12 times in 12 different countries before we're sort of so nothing really surprised me from the stuff that we'd done, but the surprises came from the contributors, including yourself. And we and as you can see, there were quite a few in the end in there, and just the amazing breadth of different people from different parts of the ecosystem that are super passionate about it, but also have had touch points with it. So we aimed for a lot for this book. To your point, we did a lot of take it to works to be able to help people understand the application. How, I mean, chapter six is from Alex Pacey, who is a CPO in Australia for OMD and or OMG. And he wrote an entire chapter on how you make change, how you bring change to your workflows and your teams with an attention lens. It was amazing. So I think those types of stories I was very grateful for, but also a little bit surprised because everyone just jumped in and went, here's some information and how can we kind of build this into the book that gives value to the reader?
Yeah, I must admit that is very striking. Actually, when you go through the book, I mean, it is very striking how many contributions there are, and the range. You're right. I mean, the range of topics that they cover. I mean, I think the brief, as I remember it, was really broad. It was just kind of, can you write something about, this whole kind of topic? And so people did obviously take all sorts of different. I mean, I was the only one to quote Dr. Johnson, mind you. So. yay for me.
Yeah.
But it's I think that is a very that's a very fair point that it is kind of really it breaks the book up. It makes it more valuable because it does have contributions from all over the place, not just
Well, and I
one.
think it validates everything we've found. So no contributions were altered,
No.
no contributions were omitted. And we took any vendor names out, including our own, to make sure that it was completely, devoid of having any kind of bias in any way, or any leading to any product. But it's, I think that was the best part for me, the contribution from the different stakeholders.
Yeah. Okay, well, the last question then, and feel free to duck this if you want to, but what's your favorite, if you look around the place, I mean, your data is now being used obviously all over the place by all kinds of different
Yeah.
people from, obviously from brands, from, academics, from researchers, from agencies and so on. What's your sort of favorite use to which your data has been put? Can you think of one
So
particularly great example?
I can, and he is mentioned in the book actually. He wasn't a contributor, but I spoke about it, is Richard Kirk's Real Reach piece. So I've since caught up with him separately around it, and so obviously my passion area is the planning side. Optimization, we see that every day where people are optimizing. Even if they remove the 1 second of intention, one second of, like if it's under a second, they remove URLs that don't have that. And then they see outcomes, clicks and, acquisitions, et cetera. That to me, that's a bit stock standard. And I love it, but it's not my most fun. My most exciting part is the people that are literally trying to make reach equal again. And these people are people like, John Waite and Richard Kirk. There are a few others globally as well, but that Richard Kirk case study, in my opinion, is the best case of trying to equalize the error that sits in under the reach-based planning process. So that's my favorite.
Okay, well, shout out for Rich Kirk. So well
Yeah.
done to him. Yeah. And Karen, thank you so much for joining us on this ASI cast. Lovely to talk to you again.
Take care.
Cheers.